Hello and welcome to this Monday's Squawker Talker. I'm your host, George Ellick. Like many other heavyweights, Greg Johnson is being rested for this FA Cup weekend. Hopefully I'll be more Bastion than Brighton. Joining us today is Mohamed Butt. Hi, Mo.
How you doing, George?
Good. And Squawker social media director, James McManus as well.
Hi, Mac. Thanks for having me on. Got a bit of a cold, so I apologise for the sniffles in advance.
Like a lot of people say that when they come into this room. It's one day.
It's a new climate in here, isn't it? That's
exactly. Exactly. So unlike others, we do take the FA Cup very seriously here, and we're going to kick off with probably the biggest upset of the weekend, which was at Anfield, with Liverpool losing 2-1 to Wolves. It wasn't really a case necessarily of a weakened team. The likes of, you know, Klavan played, Wijnaldum played, Firmino played, Origi played. Obviously, there were some youth players coming in. Are there any excuses, Macca, for the loss for Liverpool?
Not particularly. It's a mentality thing, isn't it? It's been coming a while now. Arsenal made 10 changes, the same as Liverpool did, and won 5-0 away at Southampton. So I think that it emphasises the point of the strength and depth that Liverpool have. Liverpool are making changes and they're bringing Alberto Moreno and Klavan in, who probably aren't good enough to play at Liverpool, whereas Arsenal are bringing in the likes of Theo Walcott, Danny Welbeck, Hector Bellerin, Kieran Gibbs, Perez, who they signed in the summer. So there's a lot better squad depth, a lot better quality coming in. And also Liverpool missed Sadio Mane a ridiculous amount. Liverpool have lost 6 games this season. Mane's missed 5 of them. So the only one Mane's played in where Liverpool have lost is the 4-3 freak show at Bournemouth. So his presence going behind, stretch teams, his pace, it's upset. It's what every Liverpool fan dreaded when they knew we signed Mane and he started so well, that the AFCON was going to upset the rhythm of the team. But it's moved the Lana looks knackered now, and so many key players are undercooked or underperforming.
I think it's interesting that Mane has now managed to get knocked out of 3 competitions in 4 days, given the EFL Cup defeat as well. There must be an issue with Liverpool as well, that it was Mane who missed a very easy chance to send a goal in the 119th minute and also missed the key penalty.
Yeah.
So, Mo, is there a chance he's going to come back a bit deflated and not be the spark that they need?
This is the thing. I mean, tactically, you think, yeah, Mane's coming back. Everyone can finally go back to playing where they should be. Liverpool should finally kick on. But if Mane comes back like looking like the player, I mean, you know, he completely... He was culpable for Senegal's exit at the combination. So if he comes back with that on his mind, if Klopp can't energise, I mean, Klopp's a very good motivator of players, so, you know, he probably will be able to. But if he can't do that, then, yeah, he won't really be much use to Liverpool for a while. He'll be tired as well. It's a long travel, a long tournament, hard-fought tournament. You know, it's troubling for Liverpool, but Klopp did. I mean, he rested, like, half the team. Obviously, his eye is on the Chelsea game. You know, in a dream world, I suppose, you know, Mane comes back and energises Liverpool. There's every chance. Maybe for one game, adrenaline will carry Mane through, but I think it might be a bit difficult for Mane at first coming back from that.
I think Klopp is still massively adjusting to the fact there's no winter break in England. He's resting players in late January, which isn't really when you traditionally rest players during a busy... He's resting them a month too late, so the damage is already done. They're already pretty knackered. And I don't think he's used to having 2 domestic cup competitions to take seriously either.
Yeah.
The DFL Cup is reasonably respected, but if you're a big team, chances are you're going to make the quarterfinal stages. But the Carling Cup is kind of that, or the League Cup is kind of like here. But the FA Cup, there were so many upsets this weekend that it just showed you couldn't underestimate it. It reminded me of when Rafa Benitez came over, and in 2005, the year Liverpool won the Champions League, they went out away at Burnley, because Rafa made a loads and loads of changes, and it was a really embarrassing Jimmy Choyroy backheel goal, own goal. So it is a different league, it is a different country, obviously, but the little intricacies and quirks of playing football in England, I think it does take managers longer than they anticipate to get up to speed with.
I think there's an interesting thing that, you know, Jurgen Klopp, having struggled over 2 legs against Plymouth and last season obviously against Exeter as well, he should maybe realise now that actually these teams can actually play. And surely Wolves deserve some credit for their performance as well.
Enormous amount of credit. Their goals were great. They didn't just jam a goal from a corner, you know, knock one down, scrap it. These are really well-constructed goals. They cut through Liverpool, really. And I mean, okay, you know, cutting through Liverpool isn't that difficult, especially when Alberto Moreno's at left-back. But, you know, they still did it. And I think that they went to Anfield, then they weren't cowed, they weren't afraid. They actually had a bold plan and they stuck to it. And they... accomplished their goals. It's just, it shows, I mean, you know, the quote-unquote magic of the FA Cup, whatever it is or is not, it, teams, when they believe more in their cup, it's a single leg knockout competition. You know, they're playing big teams. Big teams can often be a bit haughty about it in the earlier rounds, resting players. And these smaller teams are like, you know what, we're not just going to roll over and die like they have been maybe 5-10 years ago. They're not saying, okay, you know what, if you're going to rest players, we're going to come right at you, mate.
Exactly. And, and obviously Liverpool, we've seen how susceptible they are on the break this season. Yeah. And Wolves, obviously, and Paul Lambert, he's a good tactician. You know, you've got to look at his record before the Villa job. Did a job on Jurgen Klopp there. Focus now goes to the league for Liverpool. And the next game is Chelsea. Before we go into the preview in the game, a brief mention of what was a pretty easy win for Chelsea. Misha Batshuayi in the 4-0 win against Brentford. Misha Batshuayi got 2 assists and a goal. Ruben Loftus-Cheek came in. Is this an example of the good way to use our squad and the strength that Chelsea do have in depth?
Absolutely. I think Conte is, if above all else, a pragmatist, isn't he? He will adapt to situations. Just to go back to Jurgen Klopp briefly, I think what this period has shown, that Liverpool in 2017 have only won one out of seven games, I think it is how tactically inflexible he is. The Mane's gone and still playing 4-3-3, whereas Conte, the system... He's changed system famously this season, 2-3-5-2. I'm pretty sure he'd change it again if the occasion called for it. He's not wedded to any idea or any principle, but he's also massively got a better squad than Liverpool do. But Loftus-Cheek's been massively underused this season, hasn't he? Because he's in his halfway house where he's probably too good to be loaned out, but not quite good enough to start. So he could really do with a move in the really he should have moved on loan in the summer.
It's interesting with Loftus-Cheek. It seems like Conte came in and made up his mind very quickly that he wasn't a midfielder, and he's trying to turn him into this kind of second striker role. So I mean, maybe it will take time for him to come in. And obviously with Batshuayi, who they spent a lot of money on in the summer, it'll be difficult for him to come in. But one tactical tweak, we're going to now go into the big game of midweek, start looking at the Liverpool-Chelsea game, which is as close as you can really come to something of a title clash this season when Chelsea are so far clear. There's been a suggestion from the manager, from Conte, that he might move Pedro into that right wing-back role ahead of Moses, enabling him to play both Pedro and Willian, with Willian ahead of him. Is that something you can see working?
I mean, Pedro did it for Barcelona against PSG. He played right wing back in a Corinthian 3-3-1-3, and they beat PSG 3-1, and Pedro was really good. Neymar played left wing back. So he's done it before. Could he do it against Liverpool? I mean, James Milner is very physical. It's a bit more of a different challenge there.
Milner's knackered, though.
But he's knackered. But yeah. I think it would be exceptionally bold. It would be really attacking. I mean, Moses is an attacking player. We know this. But playing Pedro there, that would be a really, really interesting thing. I mean, Willian's playing well right now, I think. So I can see why he's thinking about making that move. It would be exceptionally bold. I think it could pay off. But it could also expose him a little bit. But the thing is, Pedro has done this before, so I can see why he's thinking about it. It makes a lot of sense. It would put the pressure on Liverpool. And of course, it's just another goal threat. Pedro's ability to score goals off either foot in off any weird position, really. You know, that's the problem. If he's making if Chelsea can congregate the play on the left hand side of the pitch, and Pedro's making weak side runs, you know, on the blind side of James Milner, that's a problem for Liverpool. So I could see him doing it. I could see why he'd do it. It might backfire, but I think it would hurt Liverpool, I think.
It's doubling up on the left-hand side, where Liverpool have looked very shaky in recent weeks because Klavan's been in pretty rotten form. Lovren was in great form when Matip was there, but his form's gone away a little bit with Klavan. Milner has to do an awful lot of work down that left-hand side. And because Coutinho doesn't track back too much, it's always up to Wijnaldum to cover across, and it could leave Liverpool stretched on the left-hand side. So it makes sense to put two attacking threats onto one pretty tired-looking James Milner.
I mean, we've seen Chelsea this season be pretty devastating on the counter-attack at times. Yeah. They can do it both ways. They can keep the ball in possession. They can also attack on the counter. The likes of Eden Hazard and Pedro and Willian are pretty breathtaking when they do break at pace. And obviously that is something that Liverpool have struggled with. Macker, is this going to be another occasion where we see Liverpool's weakening, Liverpool's weakness being a lack of defensive midfielder, lack of defenders who can defend on the break? Or do you think we'll see a different tactic from Klopp where he'll try and actually tweak it so that they can get more of a foothold in the game?
I think the City game showed that Klopp can tweak it to a sort of defensive mindset, and similarly at Man United recently as well. There was a lot of possession in Liverpool's own half, really trying to take the sting out of the game, control the crowd a bit more. So on big games, Klopp's Liverpool tend to perform very well. And I think most, it's been a weird quirk of the season so far that most, when there's two big teams going into a Premier League game at the moment, one seems to be pretty out of form, the other one seems to be flying, and it's always the one out of form that tends to surprise us. So like City the other weekend absolutely destroyed a rampant Tottenham, didn't they, and were unlucky not to win.
Absolutely.
So I think it could be another one of them. Klopp versus Conte is a hugely exciting tactical battle, but I wouldn't bet against Klopp just because they're in rotten form at the minute.
And Conte has said that he thinks that Klopp's side has the fight to take the title race all the way. Some people are saying this is just pre-match kind of chatter, just a way of him kind of make sure his players are bang at it, Mo. But Liverpool's record against the big six teams in the league is better than anyone else's, because obviously they struggle to break down two banks of four when other teams come out and play against them. So surely this could be more of a matchup than some are giving it credit for.
It could be. And I think Conte's words are obviously very carefully chosen to both motivate his players and, you know, preparatory excuses ready if they lose. But it's interesting. Maka pointed out, you know, tactically it's going to be a great battle. I really do wonder. I mean, Conte, if he doubles up on Pedro and Willian on the right-hand side, you'd think, okay, that means they're going to go at Liverpool. But it could mean that they play on the break and then they just have those two and Hazard to fly forward on counter-attack, you know, to play off Costa. If Conte is as tactically astute as he seems to be, I think he'll sit deep and I think he'll let Liverpool have the ball, because Liverpool really don't know what to do when they have the ball, especially when Coutinho and Wijnaldum and Lallana aren't really flowing. I mean, when they're all flowing, those three, Liverpool can work things out. But without those three in good form, and Lallana looks exhausted, Coutinho doesn't look in rhythm, and Wijnaldum looks confused right now. I would let, if I'm Conte, I'd let Liverpool have the ball all day, because they won't do anything with it, and you can just kill them on the counter attack.
And we saw when Spurs beat Chelsea and ended their winning run, we saw them do it basically with the front two. And in fact, it was kind of Kane playing as a striker with Ali playing just off him. Is there any chance that Klopp will look at something similar, playing Origi maybe? And for, I mean, we know Origi and Firmino haven't worked too well before, but playing that kind of two up front role in order to really try and expose the back three of Chelsea.
I think if Daniel Sturridge had done better against Southampton, I think he might be tempted to go do that sort of thing and put Sturridge and Firmino and Origi up front together. But Sturridge was so bad against Southampton in both legs. I just think Klopp will just stick with what he knows. He'll probably bank on Mane coming back and being like the saviour. Which it's just such a gamble. It could work, though. It really could work. You know, Klopp is a great, great motivator of players. We've seen it before. If he can get Anfield up for it, you know.
And we've spoken about Mane. We'll just finish on this previewing this match with him, Maka. I mean, apparently they've put him on a flight back to England to try and get him back for the game. Do you think he'll start?
I think he will. Yeah, I think the situation's kind of dire enough that. That everyone knows the system just works so much better with this one player. I think if he was a centre midfielder or he was a fullback or something, there wouldn't be quite the emphasis to get him straight in. But with Coutinho working his way back in, Firmino has really gone off the boil. Despite them two good goals against Swansea, he's been pretty rotten in for about 3 months now, I'd say. So, I mean, and Sturridge and Origi, the support cast, are in terrible form as well. So it's not good news anywhere across the board. So we're just going to pretend Mane had a sloppy end to AFCON, and just he'll definitely start, I think.
So yeah, so hopefully for all the neutrals out there, I think everyone's hoping for a Liverpool victory just to try and throw the title race back open. But back to the FA Cup, and what a fixture this was at White Hart Lane. Tottenham 4, Wickham 3. Wickham led 2-0 and then led 3-2 with going basically into injury time before Son got the fourth goal and the winner in the 97th minute. He's got 4 goals in his last 3 starts in all competitions. Is he someone that should be playing more for Spurs, Mo?
Yeah. I mean, he's inconsistent and patchy as a goal scorer, but that's partly because his appearances are inconsistent and patchy. He doesn't get regular runs or games. He plays like 3-4 games and he's on the bench. I think it's important that Spurs find a place to play him more regularly than they do. I mean, obviously, it's very hard to displace either Ali or Eriksen, especially if they keep playing 3-5-2, because those two are so important. But Son could be equally important. Yeah, they've got these three guys that they can play behind Harry Kane. They all offer something different. You know, Ali is very much, you know, he just runs and gets goals, doesn't have to involve in the play much. Eriksen's a playmaker, he's their Iniesta, you know. And then you watch Son is a dribbler, Son's a, you know, he's a dribbling goal scorer, he's a really classical, you know, modern wing forward sort of thing. I think his ability to score goals, which is something Spurs don't really have in abundance. They've only got really the one goal scorer, that's Harry Kane. They need
Dele Alli,
Dele Alli's in great form, but I mean, let's see him do it consistently over a season. You know, they need to call
the Harry Kane's one season wonder argument for Dele Alli, isn't it?
Well, no, I mean,
he's had 10 goals two seasons running. Yeah. This is what he does.
They've got to put him in a consistent goal score, because remember, there was that period where Harry Kane wasn't scoring and Spurs just weren't scoring as a result. They need to build Dele Alli into that goal scorer, but Son already is that goal scorer. Give him the consistent running games, you know, and get him firing, because those goals could be invaluable to Spurs in their title chase. Is it still a title chase? I don't know.
And he also seems to kind of pop up with very big goals as well, as we've seen, that there seems to be important ones. Pochettino made 9 changes, again showing the big respect to the FA Cup that it deserves. But they obviously maybe have a stronger squad, as we've discussed, than Liverpool. Whilst 4 goals suggests a decent attacking display, the likes of Wimmer, Davis, Trippier, Carter, Vickers did concede 3 goals to League 2 Wickham. Paul Hayes leading the line to put them 2-0 up after 36 minutes. Is this a worry, Maka, for them, that their kind of second string defenders maybe aren't up to it, especially with Alderweireld and Vertonghen both injured?
Yeah, I mean, it just puts into contrast how good those two are. I mean, they are the best fullback or the best centre back pairing in the league, also the fact if they're playing 3-5-2 to get the most out of Walker and Rose, then you need 5 really good centre halves, and Wimmer, whenever I've seen him, not been too much of a fan. I think it's quite error prone. He looks very much like a mid-table Bundesliga centre half. You get what you pay for, don't you? Same as Clavin does at Liverpool. If you pay £4 to £10 million for a centre back now, you're going to get a £4 to £10 million centre back.
If Wimmer wasn't left-footed, where would he be playing? It looks like he's made a career out of being a left-footed centre back.
It's a good niche to have. Yeah, it's a good. Yeah, but yeah, he's not. He's very average. Against weak teams at home, you're fine, but I mean, frankly, as this showed, you know, even that is kind of a risk. He needs good defenders around him. Yeah, he should be their fourth choice centre back. They need to cultivate a third choice, or if they're going to keep playing 3-5-2, like Maka says, they need 2 more centre halves, really.
Well, it's good that for all their defensive issues, next up for them in the league is Sunderland away. Probably the best away match you could possibly hope to have at the moment. They only managed a 1-0 win earlier on in the season, but Sunderland are winless in 7 in all competitions, losing 6, 16-5 down on aggregate. We're hearing today that David Moyes is going back to his old allies again.
David
Moyes. Brian Oviedo and Darren Gibson. What do you make of this recruitment policy, Maka? Is he doing well by going back to what he knows, or
he's
is
getting
he?
He's getting the band back together, isn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, he signs players you forget play still. Like Stephen Pienaar just dropped off the face of the earth for 2 years. Now he's popped up again at Sunderland. I remember I was quite a few years ago when Moyes was at Everton, and I was listening to the radio on the way to a game, I think, and I think it was Talk Sports European football correspondent said, they called him up and Everton had just signed Nuno Valente, and the Talk Sport correspondent thought he'd retired because he hadn't played for about 18 months at Porto. So Moyes has had a long career of just pulling rabbits out of a hat and just hoping for the best. But, I mean, is signing players that haven't really played football for a year a good way to drop them straight into a relegation fight?
It's like how Tarantino likes to think he can resurrect actors' careers by signing really by casting really weird actors who haven't been active for a while, except he's actually good at it and Moyes just can't seem to do it. He's just like, I'll bring him back, I'll give me loads of cult status. But no,
it seems
David.
To me that Moyes has gone to go and see Trainspotting 2 at the cinema and really enjoyed it and thought he'd try and do the same thing as Sunderland.
David Moyes has Begbie.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean look, Darren Gibson has scored against Manuel Neuer before, against Bayern Munich before, but this was all like 7 years ago and they were basically all just pot shots from range. He's a very limited player. I don't really know what he's, unless Moyes is just going to stick him right behind him in the face and say, look, just shoot all the time.
I think we have to remember that Sunderland did spend money in the summer, and that was on Didier Ndong and on Papi Djoliborji. So I have a feeling that he's been told, no, David, we're not going to give you any more cash. You've got to make do with what you've got, really.
I just think it shows the lack of imagination he had. He might have been, maybe potentially when he got the United job, given more support by Ed Woodward, who was learning on the job. But he walked into a title-winning changing room and said, what this team needs is a Marouane Fellaini, and then signed him 4 days later than the release clause ran out for more money that he himself put in. So his lack of imagination is startling, isn't it?
Absolutely. With Gibson, similar to Wimmer, someone who's made a career out of one thing, and his is just hitting the ball really, really hard. on to Southampton against Arsenal, which was, well, I should say Southampton reserves against Arsenal reserves, which was the televised game on Saturday afternoon. A resounding victory for Arsenal, 5-0 at St Mary's. Fair to say, though, Mo, that maybe the FA Cup isn't top of Southampton's agenda, which is now probably just a one-match season.
I think it would have been had they not got through to the League Cup final. I think, and actually, I think maybe even it would have been had this game not come 3 days after they'd done that. I think the timing just thought Southampton are like, okay, you know what? We've got a final title to prepare for. These players are exhausted. They just put in massive effort against Liverpool over two legs. Let's just give them a rest. Backfired spectacularly. Unsurprisingly, Arsenal have they've got a sneaky amount of depth, really, when you think about it. In key areas, they're laughably weak. Like defensive midfield, they basically just have no one except, you know, I mean, they've got three. So that's not true. They technically literally have bodies, but they technically have no one because those guys are all useless. You know, and they've got two good centre halves, that's it. But they're really strong in attack. They've got lots of different attacking options. They've got and Danny Welbeck's return, you know, I mean, what was better, the goal or the celebration? I don't know.
Always a celebration. I've always got a lot of time for Danny Welbeck. he's such a likeable player, isn't he? He's miles better than people give him credit for.
Yeah,
he'd have helped England so much at the Euros.
I mean, England fell apart without him. It was unquestioning. You know, he was a great, great, great goal. Really, really composed finish. And then the celebration just... Oh, perfect.
I think for those who couldn't see it, Mo just did the celebration in front of us.
It was glorious. I think as well, from a player's perspective, if you're in that Southampton changing room and a manager makes 10 changes and you haven't been on the fringe of the squad at all, you're not on loads of money per week, having it confirmed in such, like, stark colours and contrast that you are number two, and where's the incentive to play well in this game against Arsenal? If it's a cup run, then you know you're not playing in the next league game anyway, so where do you go? I know professional pride is important, but not every professional footballer will have that, so you're going to get performances where you get turned over 5-0 if you make 10 changes.
I think Claude Puel has kind of irked a lot of Southampton fans with his rotation policy, and it seems like here it was strange, because you think when you rotate a lot of players, normally the second string players see a lot of football anyway, but these Southampton players seem to be one of those who don't even get into the rotation. Squawkers Tashan and Danira Nalane was at the game, and he said afterwards that with everyone back and fit, Arsenal have the greatest depth in the league in attack, with the likes of Iwobi and the Ox. He's not even mentioning Danny Welbeck or hat-trick hero Theo Walcott there. Maka, is this... are these players going to be the people who can fire Arsenal to something of a title challenge, or is that too far gone now?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I've still got my doubts whether Chelsea can go on another run like they have. But, I mean, Arsenal's attacking depth is ridiculous. Olivier Giroud's been on the bench most of the season. They've got Lucas Perez, who looks good whenever they use him. Came in for a pretty hefty fee in the summer. Not really getting used that much either. Theo Walcott's their joint top earner with Sanchez and Ozil at the minute before their new deals come in, so they're spending a lot of money. So he's been criticised for years for not buying centre halves and stuff, but he's done a job at the other end, hasn't he, Wenger? So I don't think the title challenge is miles off. I do think Chelsea will probably still win it, but I mean, I think they've just Arsenaled it again, haven't they, and ran that festive period, and they seem to become such a well-known thing, but they just lived up to it, hook, line and sinker. They'll finish the season really strongly. I think they'll probably finish second, but
The key for Arsenal is if they do, because they could build up enough momentum to get into a title challenge, the key is then will they hold their nerve? Because historically, in the recent past, Arsenal's, Wenger's teams, they build up momentum, they get into a title challenge, then they panic because they're in a title challenge.
Yeah, there's another blip coming.
They lose a bunch of games, and then they realise they're out of the title challenge, there's no pressure, then they start winning again, because they're actually a really good team. It's just whether they can hold their nerve, honestly. They're good enough if Alexis comes back in good form, if they can keep these forwards fit. Crucially, if they keep Mustafi hit. Mustafi is the key one. Koscielny's a better defender, obviously, individually, but Mustafi's the one who can organise defences, who can lead the defence, which is what they really miss. If they can keep Mustafi fit, you know, they've got a chance, but it's just whether they can hold their nerve then after that.
Haven't lost a league game with Mustafi yet either. Arsenal haven't, so I think he's played 10 and Arsenal haven't lost a game yet, so...
There have to be still, we've discussed it on the pod before, there have to be issues with their midfield still, and Mohamed Elneny getting injured at AFCON is a huge blow, surely,
to
them.
Yeah, well, I mean, their depth, like I said, their depth in midfield is really, it literally exists, but it may as well not. I mean, Coquelin just runs around and tackles people. Granit Xhaka has not adapted to the Premier League at all. He still needs time. I mean, there's love to tackle, and then there's this guy. You know, he adores tackling. It's like the cover of the notebook will be Granit Xhaka and two-footed tackles. That's, you know, he loves that stuff. You know, so they don't really have a consistent player that is in there that you can rely upon, except, of course, the perennially injured Santi Cazorla.
I think Elneny getting injured is only really an issue because Xhaka can't control himself. So, I mean, Wenger's famously faithful to his players, will give him too much faith. And the way he kind of hung Xhaka out to dry in the press conference, he'd warned him after the Swansea sending off that he had to stop letting his teammates down, stop going to ground. But he kind of went into sort of forensic detail last week, saying he's... we had a report out from our chief reporter, Greg Stobart, said Arsenal worried about Xhaka's lack of mobility, which... I don't know what the scouts are doing, but you'd think that'd be a thing that he'd highlight if a 6'1" holding man can actually run. But he's not a holding man, is he? He's not a midfield general. He's not box to box. He's a deep line playmaker who just happens to look like a defensive midfielder.
Yeah.
And his tackling technique is panicky, and some of it he's gets a bit frozen on the ball sometimes. You can see with Xhaka that he panics. He'll have like 95% pass accuracy in a game, but the one that he lets get away from him is just when players are running at him, and he kind of panics a bit. So he kind of has this lack of composure at times.
It reminds me of Michael Carrick, actually, who's very, very, very good, but when you press him, is very vulnerable to turning the ball over. It's that same sort of thing. He needs a lot of time and space, basically.
I think that's exactly why Elneny is such a big miss for them, because that kind of... that panic on the ball is something we definitely see from both Ramsey and Kokana as well. Yeah. They need that kind of cool head in the middle of the park, which they do miss with Cazorla. Next up for Arsenal in midweek is Watford, who, if we're honest, are having an absolutely torrid time at the moment. They're in 14th spot on 24 points, and that 40-point mark can't come soon enough for them. Their FA Cup tie, they went to Millwall and got beaten 1-0, and very, very well beaten as well. Millwall, if a neutral was watching that game, having never seen either team before, I'm pretty confident they'd have thought Millwall was a Premier League side. Troy Deeney came on in the 77th minute, at which time Watford had had just one shot, which was a speculative effort from 30 yards, which went wide. David Maloney on Twitter has asked us to talk about Watford, and specifically Walter Mazzari, and asks, has he adapted to England? Lots of talk on Twitter that he may be on his way sooner rather than later after replacing Kike Flores in the summer. Maka, what do you reckon for Watford?
I mean, it's a strange situation. The way Watford and Granada and Udinese, owned by the Pozzo family, are set up, that they just constantly interchange players, and it's almost like a halfway house. It's like you pass through or onto going somewhere else. And Watford have, without a doubt, assembled the weirdest squad in the Premier League. What's the plan? What's the style of play? What's the common thread player to player? Leicester's trying to rival it. They've got a very odd squad now, but Watford's is just very, very strange. Like, they signed Mauro Zarate, a player you just don't... Why have they signed him? What are they expecting Mauro Zarate to do for them in the next 3 months that players already within the squad can't do? Niang is probably a good signing, but it makes you think if they were able to get him, then maybe he wasn't that good anyway, because he was linked with Arsenal and Liverpool 6 months ago, and only Watford had no competition to sign him. So what's going on there? I think they are in danger. Kike Sanchez Flores just seemed exasperated last season, that he was battling uphill, had a really good cup run, wasn't really supported in the transfer market too much in January, and the results inevitably fell away, which he kind of warned them it would do. But he was a very, very good manager.
He's doing brilliantly at Espanyol right now. They're in a great run. They beat Sevilla yesterday. So, you know, they're playing. He's a great manager. He wasn't the problem. People assumed he was, but no.
But I don't know what the problem was. It seemed like he set the bar too high and then was a victim to his own success in the second half of the season.
It's unsustainable, their model. Bringing in 15 players every season, letting go 14, signing one, loaning to another club that's owned by the same family, changing managers every 9 months. It's just unsustainable. It's gonna get them in trouble. If it's this season, then it will be next season.
And I mean, if you look at their centre midfield yesterday, the likes of, you know, Ben Watson and Doucouré, and it's not particularly a surprise that they went down. I mean, the Niang signing, Mo, reminds me somewhat of Juan Aturbe going to Bournemouth last season. You know, a player with such a huge reputation a player with such huge reputation amongst those who maybe watch more football on YouTube than on TV, comes in. Can Watford fans expect from him?
I don't know. He's a really, really talented player. He's got a lot of goals in him. Yeah, he's But you know, it's like Milan let him go for a reason. You know what I mean? That he's inconsistent. He's a bit of a diva as well. I mean, they replaced him with Della Feu, so I think that they just wanted a different kind of diva, frankly. But you know, he
is that the title of your upcoming album, Boat? Mohamed Boat, a different kind of diva.
Yeah. Well, no, you know, he's a talented player. He's a wing forward. He can score goals. He can play up front. He can create goals, but he's just not consistent. I don't know how old he is now, actually, but he still plays like he did when he was 17 when he first broke through. He was really, really good as a teenager. He's one of those players that never really progressed from being a teenage footballer, which is sad.
I'd say the same about myself, I reckon.
Who knows if he settles in the Premier League? Yeah, he's got a lot of talent. You never know. It's really hard to predict, you know.
You just wonder if Watford have the players to give him the ball and the service that he needs enough because he's not going to do much defensively.
I think you play him up front with Troy Deeney and you just hope for the best, basically. If they hit it off, then it could be kind of like Deeney and Ighalo were last season before Ighalo just stopped scoring for some reason.
You wonder if Watford are regretting not taking the money for Ighalo in the summer.
They absolutely should have done that.
That's unbelievable. Moving on to the Manchester United against Wigan game, which shockingly was on TV. I think it's the 57th FA Cup game in a row that
United have had on. That's the only reason.
Since 2005, meaning that Wayne Rooney has never played in an FA Cup tie in a Man United shirt, not on TV.
Wow. That is staggering, isn't it?
Which is absolutely incredible. It was in a weekend of shocks, I suppose you have to kind of applaud the professional nature with which they did it. I think the main talking point has to be Bastian Schweinsteiger, who came in and played that kind of Carrick role better than Carrick has been.
Well, because he is better than Michael Carrick. It's like this is
no, he's not.
They've got this absolute
nonsense.
They've had this absolute world class midfielder just sort of sitting there, and
he's not world class anymore.
He's still got it.
He's got over a kick from 6 yards against Wigan. He's world class.
He's still got it. You wait. No, it's one of those things. Like, it's like Mourinho didn't play Mkhitaryan for 3 months, then played like, look, I'm such a good coach. He's started playing brilliantly now. It's like now he'll say that he this was his plan all along, was to rest Schweinsteiger for the first half of the season and then bring him in to rotate with Carrick, which I mean. That you know, if that was his plan, it worked. But that wasn't his plan. He was just freezing him out because he was being awkward.
There was no buyer, basically, so he couldn't get rid of.
Yeah,
his
so wages. And then, so but now he's like, okay, well, you know what? I may as well use him. He's not going to cost me anything except wages. So yeah, sure, go on then. Yeah, he was really good against Wigan. He ran the show. It was Wigan though, so you have to put that caveat on it.
But I think surely this weekend means that you can't be making those kind of comments anymore. We've seen a lot of more regular players really struggle against these teams. Who, as you say, I mean, they're there for the cup. They press.
Wigan went for it. They weren't sitting back. They weren't having it. I mean, if Michael Jacobs takes that chance that Masri teed up for him, I mean, you never know. You never know if they'd scored first. It could have been anything, but because United took a long time to get going. They weren't really good first half.
Schweinsteiger got the assist for the first goal, scored the fourth goal, and he completed 93% of his 109 passes, which is
a really good
stats. Quite a interesting question here from Nikhil Krishna.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure, Maki, I know the answer to this one, but I'll ask you anyway. Zlatan, Martial, Rashford, Rooney. Who brings out the best in the team as a whole?
Out of them five?
Yes.
Them four,
Them
even.
Four, yeah.
Well, Zlatan, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because Zlatan makes Paul Pogba play well. And if you spend £89 million on a player, then you want to surround him with players that he links up with well. I think we've talked about, like Mourinho said, about Martial being put through the Mkhitaryan process at Man United, which I think Jose Mourinho is... That is an absolutely fraudulent claim, isn't it? Because everyone knows he throws Mkhitaryan out because he wanted to prove a point that he was still the big boss man.
It's Joe Cole in him, isn't it?
And then Mkhitaryan came back in, played exactly how he was signed to play and should have been playing 3 months earlier. So rather than admitting I made a mistake, I should have been playing this guy for 3 months, he went, no, I've put him through a process. What is the process apart from hanging him out to dry in the media and then him actually just being a good footballer? So he's trying to take, he's challenging Martial with this, and he knows Martial's good enough to play well again for Man United, and he's going to claim credit for that again, which is nonsense, isn't it?
I think in all competitions, Martial's now got 6 goals and 5 assists, which, considering how little he's played, is quite odd for Mourinho to say he doesn't do enough in games.
Yeah, every time he plays well, Mourinho drops him for the next game. So I think it could just be that whether Mourinho believes he's keeping a young man in check, but without letting his ego get the best of him or something. I don't know. It's like he's a really good footballer. Play him every week. He seems pretty grounded. Doesn't seem like he's too extravagant or anything. Play him every week. He's fine.
I think Martial has just been pretty unfairly treated by the media in general, because he's a young 20-year-old guy. Apparently, he's going through a pretty bitter breakup, and we like to pretend footballers are immune to emotions just because they're paid 200 grand a week. But I mean, that will affect him off the pitch, yeah. And that will inevitably affect him on the pitch. And then you've got Jose Mourinho going, I'm going to put you through a process which I've literally just made up off the back of my hand. And it's just like, Martial was told by Gary Neville on Twitter at the weekend, he was like, I'd like to see him play with a bit more passion and smile on his face. And like, that is just amateur psychology gone mad, that is. What does Gary Neville know that if Martial's enjoying playing football? Of course he is.
Yeah, and Gary Neville seemed to rarely smile on the pitch unless he was scoring against Arsenal.
Yeah, I thought Paul Ansorge put Gary Neville in his place quite eloquently on Twitter. It was just like, you know, you don't know. Martial's character seems to be much more a reserved person, you know, in general.
That the photo of him when he was like 11 and then when he was 21, just walking around the same, like, not bothered face. That's him as a person, which is a good strength of character to have if you're going to be a top footballer.
Absolutely. I mean, United have now won 6 games by 4 goals or more under Mourinho, 2 games more than Van Gaal managed in his 2 years in charge. Clarzy de Clarzy on Twitter asks, Mo, is Mourinho now showing he is more than just a defensive coach?
No. This is when Mourinho's teams have always scored goals. I mean, his Chelsea team in 2005 is still one of the most incredible attacking teams I've ever seen, defensively and attacking. They were brilliant. They scored, I think their goal record is still the highest goals ever scored in a league season.
Yeah.
Most wins in a league season. Mourinho's teams have always, his Real Madrid team, my goodness, his teams have always learned how to attack. That's never been the thing. The reason Mourinho is called a defensive coach is because in the big games, his plan is defensive. In every big game, his plan is defense first. You know, and whether that's from his days as Porto when he had to do that, or whether that's because that's just who he is as a coach. You know, no, he's in the big games, he's still been largely just been defensive, played on the break, you know, tried to contain his opponent rather than take it to them. That's the difference. It's not in the smaller games against weaker teams. Of course his team's attacking. They're really good. His team has got, he's got Zlatan and Pogba. Of course he's going to be an attack. His teams are going to attack and they're going to score lots of goals. No, no, he's still not proven that he is, like Pep, for example, an attack-first coach. You know,
I was waiting for that.
Well, Conte's another one. You know, Conte's a pragmatist. I mean, he'll be defence-first if he has to be, but Conte will also go into some games and go be attack-first. Jurgen Klopp, attack-first. You know, these are attacking coaches. Mourinho's not. Mourinho's a defensive coach, still is.
Well, Mourinho and United have got Hull next in the week. I would say they'd be looking for revenge after the 2-1 defeat, but it seems like Mourinho still thinks they drew 1-1.
The Mike Phelan derby.
Indeed. United are still, however, the only Premier League side in 4 competitions. So I think it looks quite likely that they could go quite far. I mean, they're in the final of 1, but they could go quite far in 3. Another Manchester team, Manchester City, this looks like their best chance of silverware this season. Obviously still in the Champions League, but that looks a tall order for a team who struggle for form so much. Maka, another easy win, 3-0. They seem to like playing in London. No Aguero, no problem. Gabriel Jesus started, Sterling and Sané scored. Nepsiv of Twitter asks, does this trio have all the qualities to be world beaters?
Absolutely, but they paid an absolute arm and a leg for them, didn't they? I mean, Sané and Jesus weren't, if you look at where else City are struggling, fullback, centre back, they probably should have prioritised these over Leroy Sané. No one else was going to buy him this summer, I don't think. Gabriel Jesus, he can kind of understand wanting to get in there early because it's a South American wonder kid.
Barca and Real Madrid were looking at that.
Yeah,
he
was probably going to go somewhere, so you can understand that. But on the question, do they have the quality to be a world-class trio? Absolutely. I'm still a big believer in Raheem Sterling. Think he's more adapted. He just can't shoot. That's his only weak spot, but it's a very obvious weak spot for an attacking player to have.
Yeah,
so he gets a lot of criticism
Andres
for it.
Andres Iniesta can't shoot, man. You made a mess of it.
No, he can't. Yeah, but he doesn't have to, I guess.
Well, that's the thing. Why Sterling doesn't have to. He can become an engine of creation.
Iniesta scored 2 of the biggest goals in kind of world,
history. And yet he can't shoot. It's the weirdest thing.
Mesut Ozil can't shoot, to be fair, either. He's a brilliant playmaker.
He can chip.
I think Sterling is a fantastic player. I think this trio is great. Gabriel Jesus playing up front on his own, you know, just looks so comfortable. You know, he's going to get rid of Aguero. I think they'll sell Aguero in the summer.
Yeah. You know, PSG or Real Madrid or someone.
Yeah, I just think Gabriel Jesus just looks so utterly comfortable.
This is one for you then. Another question off Twitter as well from Emmanuel Oluskan. Yeah. I think I know which way you're going to go. Try and keep it below 500 words. Iheanacho or Gabriel Jesus?
Oh, Gabriel Jesus. Absolutely. I mean, I like Iheanacho. I think he's very good. I think he's kind of been underrated because of his struggles recently. People are saying that he's not any good or anything like that. No, he's very good still. But no, Gabriel Jesus is world-class talent in the making. He's absolutely stupendous. Regular international for Brazil, number 9. You know, helped Palmeiras win their first title since forever. I can't remember. You know, helped Brazil win the Olympics. This guy is bona fide world class in the making. He's so good. And the only question was, how quickly will he adapt to England? Because England is very different to anywhere else in the world, English football. And so far, the answer seems to be pretty well. So we'll see next season when he has to deal with the no Brinter break. That's the big test for me in a year's time. But for now, he looks very comfortable. Gabriel Jesus all day.
I haven't seen loads of Gabriel Jesus. I go in actually just because I've seen more of him. And he just seems to do something every time he plays, like as a goal or assist or a chance. He makes the team play better, which is a sign of a good attacker. What I like about Jesus, though, is he reminds me a bit of Luis Suarez, that he's aggy with the ref, treats everything as a great injustice.
Oh, yeah.
Doesn't really stop moving, can drift out wide, can play. You can imagine him in a three or a two, would kind of make the best of a system. He kind of played out wide and up top in Brazil as well, so... I mean, he does. What a great option that is going forward. They're starting to plan for a departure for Sergio Aguero, who's one of the best strikers in the world, isn't he? And he's starting to look less and less relevant to this Man City team going forward.
And it'll be very interesting to see where he ends up as well. I'm sure there'll be a bit of a bidding war for him when it comes around.
I keep thinking PSG, but like. I think maybe the car could be suited to that as well. There's going to be some sort of striker.
I think it'll go China.
Carousel.
Ooh, I think he'd fit into any Premier League team.
Oh, he would, absolutely.
They just wouldn't sell him.
They wouldn't sell him to Premier League. They're not stupid. They're not going to hand to
I can't see Real Madrid or Barcelona being interested.
Real Madrid are going for Aubameyang.
Back to Atleti, maybe. But
maybe.
But talking the Premier League, City next go to the London Stadium, where they obviously had the fantastic 5-0 win on their last trip in the Cup. Yaya Toure scored in the win against Palace. Some people pointing to his form as being important to City going forward. I personally am of the opinion that those two goals he scored on his return to the starting lineup against Palace is the worst thing that's happened to City this season. They'd only lost one game in the league when he came in. They've lost four in the 11 since.
Yeah.
Is he still right for this team?
In defensive midfield, yes. In central midfield, no. And the problem is, until like the last two, three games, Pep was playing him in central midfield. And he slows them down. He doesn't use the ball quick enough. That's why Pep pushed Busquets ahead of him in 2009 way back, because even back then Yaya didn't recycle the ball fast enough, he pondered on it too much. He doesn't use it, he's a different kind of attacking midfielder. He's a phenomenal player, but world class talent in his day, but he doesn't use the ball in the right way for Pep's system. As a defensive midfielder, he's not the ideal solution. The ideal solution is someone more like Busquets, or if they could sign him in summer, Julian Weigel would be great for City. But he's good enough there. He's still got that talent. He can control the ball. He can move it around, recycle a possession. We saw it again against Palace. You know, against Spurs, he did the same thing. Playing in defensive midfield, Yaya Toure is good enough, but he can't play further forward. He cannot. They absolutely cannot. It will destroy them, as it has this season, like you say.
And then they play against resurgent West Ham, who seem to be flourishing in life after Payet, with Lanzini taking on most of the creator's responsibility. Yeah. Palace, on the other hand, have no wins in 10 bar their FA Cup replay against Bolton. Sam Allardyce seems to be doing this similar job to Moyes, but actually he's bringing in players who helped him achieve the relegation survival goal last season, as opposed to 8 years ago, with Patrick Van Aanholt coming in. He's chasing Jan and Villa, obviously trying to sort something out of Palace. They go away to Bournemouth next. Everyone seems to be able to score at least one against Bournemouth, so maybe there'll be some respite there for Sam. Looking at the other results in the FA Cup briefly, there were three big shocks in the FA Cup, namely Oxford United beating Newcastle 3-0 at home, Sutton beating Leeds, and Lincoln beating Brighton. Newcastle, Leeds and Brighton make up the top, I think three of the top four in the Championship at the moment, all made massive changes to their lineup. I think Newcastle 9 and Leeds 10, and Brighton a fair few as well. You know, if you win the FA Cup fourth round, your four wins from Europe and your two wins from an FA Cup semi-final at Wembley. And these clubs, obviously, whilst promotions to the Premier League must be the main aim, at the same time, they possess squads, especially Newcastle squads, very much capable of doing so. Is this a mistake? Are they not showing these clubs the respect they deserve?
I think Newcastle, Rafa's a bit worried about their up and down form. So they've been a bit back and forth for the last month. I think they won 10 games in the bounce, or 9, 10 games in the bounce before that. So he's probably really trying to preserve them, because it doesn't look like they're going to catch Brighton, to be honest, at this stage, but they have to keep one eye on the teams behind them. So that was very much let's just preserve players like Matt Ritchie and make sure they're sharp for the business end of the season.
Until Ritchie came on.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was like, oh, we're losing. Yeah, can you go on and do stuff again now? I mean, it is an odd decision to me. I can understand, but I guess at the same time, you can understand it because of all the money in the Premier League now. There's just even more than there was last year, that if you get up, then you are just sorted financially for the next... It just puts things like parachute payments into context as a really small amount. But fair play to Oxford, though. That's a great result. You must be chuffed.
Yeah. So without going too partisan, let's just say I was there and I left the stadium very happy. I think that Oxford are a team that maybe, and try not to be biased here, people should keep an eye out in the future rounds, because most players that we have were taken, or that Oxford have, were taken from kind of academies around England, who are very young players who are technically very gifted. So I think Rafa may have got a bit of a shot there. Sutton, though, what a result for them on their plastic pitch. I mean, surely if they keep getting home draws on the 3G, they could keep, you know, surprising people.
Honestly, Premier League teams will go there, think it's a training session, and just be like, oh, okay, and just take it easy. No, they were brilliant, and they more than deserved to beat Leeds. They absolutely battered them. I mean, Deacon was just incredible. He shot, he's shooting from range. I mean, you know, when you can do that, when you have players who can do that sort of thing, you can be very organised defensively, and then if you just give him half a yard of space to get a shot off, he shoots so well. You know, you could nick a goal just from that alone. Forget your regular play, which is really good anyway. You know, and they were really good. And Silvestri, you know, he was in great form keeping them out, you know, with his great saves, keeping Deacon at bay. And then, of course, it told even on him. He made a mistake for the penalty, which was, you know, tucked away in brilliant fashion by the captain. You know, left foot penalty from a chubby centre-half.
What a pen.
Just brilliant.
Chubby centre-half.
I mean, they more than deserve...
you can't deny it, can you?
They more than deserve that win. That was incredible. And I really hope they get a big team at home.
But I think that's... Round. With these three results, I mean, Lincoln, more than anyone, just, you know, they've absolutely battered Brighton, having gone 1-0 down at half-time. Yeah. Surely this is a case where, you know, it's Newcastle fans, Leeds fans, Brighton fans will now say in their defence, you know, we played a weakened team, you know, it's not that impressive. But actually, it's their manager's almost tactical flaws in playing a team that... They should have put out a team good enough to win these games. They went into the fixtures wanting to win. The supporting fans would expect them to win, and they haven't really turned up.
I think it's like Klopp. You could lump Klopp in with them as well. It doesn't look like they've done their homework on the opposition properly, that if they're going in and making 10 changes, that's a bit... It's not only it's a bit insulting to the players that you're bringing in, but it is a bit insulting to the opposition. But more importantly, Newcastle, Leeds and Brighton have all travelled away from home as well. So... Newcastle to Oxford's not a short trip, is it?
No.
So,
they sold out. I mean, I think you needed 60 points in your season ticket to get a ticket, which is a lot. So
yeah, it's just, I mean, we talk about the magic of the FA Cup, and it is if you're a Sutton fan, but if you're a Leeds fan, it's a waste of a weekend that you could have spent at home base or something, doing the garden a bit better.
Absolutely, and everyone likes a good news story. So just a little pearl from the Kassam when Alexander Mitrovic turned to the Oxford fans after about 15 minutes and made some unsavoury gestures, only to fall over the ball in the 6-yard box about a minute later and then miss a penalty at 1-0. So
pretty funny.
Everyone loves Mitro. So just the other results from the weekend: Middlesbrough beat Accrington 1-0. Blackburn and Blackpool 1-2. Sorry, Blackburn beat Blackpool 2-0. In front of no fans due to the protests against both
the best
clubs
thing was
as owners.
Was it golf balls being hit into the stadium?
Yeah, exactly.
That was funny.
Sounds quite terrifying. Blackburn's rivals are through as well, 2-0 at home to Bristol City. Rochdale were humbled 4-0 at home against Huddersfield, who are obviously high-flying in the league and show that you can do both. And Derby and Leicester will meet again in the week after a 2-2 draw. Other teams meeting in the week in the Premier League, we have Middlesbrough against West Brom, which I think you'll both agree is a game that I wouldn't particularly like to watch.
Maybe watch the highlights for Adama Traore, that'd be about it.
That's very true. Swansea-Sampton's going to be an interesting on Macca. I think Neil Clement will see this as a game he can definitely potentially win and continue his good start.
Absolutely, but at the same time, Southampton, they've got them 10 changes to come back into their 11 as well, and they'll be a bit more refreshed. And Southampton's actual first 11 is in very good form at the minute. And Paul Clement, although he has got a job in his hands, but the rumours to Chelsea have died down a bit now. They do have one of the most informed strikers in the Premier League, and they're actually creating again. The fullbacks are getting forward again, so they look not quite a lost cause now that they did a few months ago.
And Burnley host Leicester. I mean, surely that's a home win for Burnley. And who'd have thought we'd be saying that 6 months ago?
Stephen Defoe, if he can play like he did in the cup with that chip, I mean, forget about it. Leicester are dead. That was incredible. That's the goal of the round. Goal of the probably, maybe even goal of the tournament this year. That was just sensational chip. And the assist for the first goal was really nice too. No, yeah, Burnley are really coming into some home form. I mean, they've been there all season, but they're really picking it up now. I think with Defoe playing well. Yeah, oh, absolutely. There's no reason why this couldn't be an easy home when Leicester are all over the place.
And on Wednesday, Stoke host Everton. Obviously, Everton in great form. Stoke, Bojan has left Stoke to go to Mainz. What do you make of that transfer? Another very unlikely line from a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it just seemed to... Mike Hughes just seemed to lose faith in him. It is maybe not as well known as it might be, but Bojan has had a bit of an issue through his career that he gets nervous playing in front of crowds. So when he had a loan spell at Ajax, it didn't work very well. He actually got called up to Spain's Euro 2008 squad the year they won it, and he turned down the call up that summer because he said he didn't feel mentally right to take on the tournament. So I think his career is going to continue to be peaks and troughs because of this nervous condition he has, which is completely understandable. But it doesn't help if you've got Mark Hughes, who just completely lost faith in him, and he's still playing Mame Diouf, Marco Arnautovic, and Peter Crouch, these mercurial figures that you don't know what they're going to deliver 1 week to the next. But
it's so funny because I remember back in like 2008, it was Pato and Bojan looked like they were going to be the future world-beating, world-breaking strikers, and now one's in China and one's just gone on loan to Mainz. It's just like
shocking that heavy expectations can have such negative.
Well, I mean, they were both 17 years old at the time. Yeah, exactly. Maybe everyone was just jumping the gun a little bit, but
and maybe Mac is. You know, what we just learned about Bojan would explain his somewhat poor penalty record as well in the Premier League. On to Europe, where in La Liga, after a brief wobble, Real Madrid are back in control of La Liga after a 3-0 victory over Real Sociedad last night. Barcelona were denied a win in their 1-1 draw with Real Betis after the ball clearly crossed the line. And Eric Matej asks on Twitter, Mo, why doesn't La Liga have goal line technology?
Because La Liga is 10 years ahead on the pitch, 10 years behind off it, basically. That's the best way to sum up. Their organisation is just terrible. It's inching slowly towards competence, but it's still not there yet. The referees are awful anyway, and then there's just no technology. No, look, Barcelona, it's funny to say, because they were literally, they should have won the game. They should have scored 2 goals, better scored 1, but really they were outplayed, completely and utterly outplayed. I've never seen Barcelona play that bad. Apart outside of the Bilardo Celta Vigo's arena for ages, they were absolutely dominated. Betis were fantastic. 5-3-2 shape absolutely destroyed Barca, and they really should have won like 5-2, I suppose, or something like that. Real Madrid, however, didn't necessarily play too well, but they found 2-3 moments of really, really good magic to pounce on. Inigo Martinez's mistakes, scored 2 nice goals. La Liga looks over again. They're three matches ahead of Barcelona, but you never know. But Barca have a horrible, horrible month coming up. Sevilla losing away to Espanyol was, I mean, Kike Sanchez was very good, but that was baffling.
Yeah, so Sevilla lost away at Espanyol, having been sent off, had a man sent off after like 4 minutes and being a goal down. In my opinion, it's the Champions League. It will be their best chance of silverware, so watch this space. Going on to the Bundesliga, Hoffenheim finally were beaten in a 2-1 defeat to RB Leipzig. After they went down to 10 men. So Leipzig keeping the pressure on Bayern, who triumphed over Werder Bremen 2-1, maintaining this run of form where they're squeezing past teams as opposed to dominating against them. Dortmund drew 1-1 with Thomas Tuchel and Jurgen Klopp's former club Mainz, and Gladbach and Leverkusen saw a 5-goal thriller as the Foles won 3-2. Eintracht got back on track after beating Schalke 1-0 away from home, and they remain third, 10 points behind Leipzig. Bundesliga still looks a two-horse race, and surely, Macaduta, Bayern's, you know, patchy form, even though picking up points, Leipzig is still banging with a chance of pushing them all away.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what it's like. The pitch is like end of March. Leipzig have done an incredible job, but you'd like to think Bayern's squad depth is just going to play a part eventually. Leipzig don't have the level of player that they can bring in off the bench continually. I guess they don't have Europe or to worry about, and the cup competitions aren't as big over there, so it literally is just a league. But Bayern should make it a one-horse race within a month or two, I'd say.
And into Serie A, where Juve beat Sassuolo, and second place Roma lost to Sampdoria, and third place Napoli drew with Palermo. It looked briefly like Serie A was becoming a competition again, but that weekend seems to have ruled that out. But Inter can maintain their absolutely superb form, beating Pescara 3-0. Stephen Shang on Twitter asks, given their current form, where can Inter finish this season? They're currently fourth. Mo?
Where can they finish? I mean, they could keep going. They won't finish first. They could finish second. In fact, second is in play. They're 5 points behind Roma. You know, they're playing well inexplicably after a poor start. If Gabigol starts firing, it gets really into the kind of form we know he can. His ability will deliver. They could finish second if they keep this up. I mean, they're not going to finish. It's kind of weird to say thing to say in Serie A, because basically everyone's competing for second place because Juve are going to win the league. They're so much better than everyone else, better run than everyone else. You know, they're bringing more money than everyone else because they actually built their own stadium very intelligently. It's smaller capacity, but they get all the money. They don't have to share the money with the local council. No, Inter could finish second if they keep playing this well. That's basically it, really.
So, Stephen, you can hope for a good flourishing end to the season for Inter and back into the Champions League. In Ligue 1, Nice closed the gap with Monaco with a 3-1 win, with Monaco only remaining top thanks to their superior goal difference after a 1-1 draw at Paris Saint-Germain, which is obviously a great result. Bernardo Silva grabbing an equaliser very late on in injury time. Marseille prepared the ground for Dimitri Payet's return with a 5-1 win over Lorient. What does his sale to Marseille mean, Maka, or is this just a case of one player just wanting to go home?
Yeah, I mean, Payet apparently was never happy in London, was he? So he'd moved his wife and his children over there even before West Ham had even said they would enter talks with Marseille. But it just shows you player power is king. No matter what a club says, every player is bigger than the club in the current environment. Not no player is bigger than the club. But Marseille now, they signed Patrice Evra last week as well, so they've essentially got France's left-hand side from the Euros playing for them. It's exciting to have like a kind of a new powerhouse with a bit of money behind them in Ligue 1. Like, Marseille is a great historical club, but they've been absolutely skint for ages, haven't they? They lost Bielsa in last summer. A lot of players have left over that period of time. They're very much a selling club, but this is quite a statement sign, isn't it? 25 million for Payet, so it's interesting for the league.
Definitely. And, you know, a lot of football we've got through today. Mel, I'm going to come to you first. Who is your player of the weekend?
Oh, Dani Ceballos, Real Betis. Number 10, played central midfield in a 5-3-2 against Barcelona. Absolutely ran the show. Was just sensational. Was defending, tracking back, defending them, you know, blocking them off, counter-attacks, shutting down, getting forward, dribbling with the ball, running past players, diving spectacularly. I mean, literally, he's some of the best dives you'll see, you know, recently. He's known for his diving, and it's just some really, really convincing dives that you only had to see slow motion replays to get. Just sent two rasping shots.
They played Barcelona, by the way. That's why Mo's noticed the dives.
Dani Ceballos is known for his diving antics, and they're sensational dives. No, really they are. If you look at them, if you want to learn how to dive, but kids don't dive. But if you want to learn how to dive, watch Dani Ceballos.
I thought I'd know the day where we're talking about player of the weekend, and it's he did some great dives.
No, they were. No, but seriously,
14 dives.
His overall play was just outrageous. He ran the show. He looked like Iniesta combined with, I don't know, Lampard or something. He was just so good. He's 20 years old. I think he's destined for really, really great things. The two shots off the bar just, you know, looked, I mean, he was just inches away from two incredible goals against Barcelona. You know, he's really, really special. And I think, yeah, I'd be amazed if he's still at Betis next season.
Well, for those wondering, Skorker don't at the moment and have no plans to provide dive completion rates at the moment, despite what Mo says. Maka, who is yours? Who is your player of the weekend?
I'm going to keep it pretty sure. It's Danny Welbeck, just because I like seeing him playing again.
Fair enough. I mean, normally we say outside the Premier League, but obviously that was the FA Cup, and hence I'm going for Simon Eastwood, the Oxford United number one, who saved Mitrovic's penalty and made a string of fantastic saves to keep Oxford in the game to beat Newcastle and Benitez. Finally, just a word on the AFCON, where we've reached the semi-final stage now. Hervé Renard lost his third AFCON game as manager in 23 as Morocco were knocked out by Egypt, who will play Burkina Faso on Wednesday after they defeated Tunisia in the quarterfinal. And Thursday we'll see Cameroon take on Ghana after Cameroon beat Senegal on penalties and Ghana beat Congo. I'm going to ask you both for a prediction on finalists and winner. Mo.
Finalists, I'm going to go with Ghana versus Egypt. Winner, Egypt. You just always, I mean, in my experience, you always back Egypt at this time of the tournament. They just have a great tournament mentality. They seem to be able to get it over the line. They drew their first game 0-0. They won two subsequent games 1-1. 1-0, sorry. I just think they won the knockout game against Morocco 1-0. I just think they'll find a way to get it done. It won't be, maybe it won't be very romantic and beautiful, but I think they'll just find a way to get it done, as they did so many times in the past.
Maka?
I'm going to go with Egypt-Cameroon final. Like Mo said about Egypt's history and the tournament, they just seem to be a tournament team. They've never really done anything outside the AFCON, have they, in any major tournament? But they're kind of like the like West Germany was and Italy were in the 90s and 80s and 70s with World Cups. They just seem to turn up no matter what shape or form they're in. They just get the job done. So I'm going to go with Egypt as well.
In Mo Salah, they certainly have one of the stars of the competition, and they're yet to concede a goal so far in the competition, either Egypt. I personally will be rooting for Burkina Faso, but I think I agree that Egypt will probably come out on top. That's all we've got time for today, and thank you very much for listening. You'll be glad to hear that Nick will be back on the Net Squawker Talker and probably Greg next week. But thank you very much.